Let's jump into some teaching. What do you say? I love the Word of God, and I love teaching it, and I'm looking forward to sharing with you this morning. We just wrapped up last week our series on basic training, and this morning was a bit unscheduled, honestly. This is a bit of a pivot for us, which, you know, we can do. Because we're just an independent, this is the Wild West of spirituality. We just do whatever we want to do. But a couple weeks ago when we announced baptisms at the Sunrise Festival, somebody approached me after the service and said, hey, I'd like to be baptized, but I can't do that weekend. When's the next chance for me? And I thought, well, there isn't another chance on the calendar, so let's just do it. And then once we said we were going to do it, we got lots of folks who wanted to be baptized. So I thought this would be a good day to talk about a new life in Christ, explain what it is that we're doing here, and why this life transition is so important. So I want to talk to you this morning about going home. And we're going to be teaching this morning out of Luke chapter 15. Christ is teaching here, and he talks about lost things. In Luke 15, he starts off talking about a lamb that's lost and how a shepherd goes looking for him. And then he talks about a lady who lost a coin and she lights a lamp and she goes searching everywhere. And then he moves to a story about a lost son. I'm sure you've heard it 100 times. Let's read it together. It's out of Luke 15, starting with verse 11. And here's what it says. There was a man who had 2 sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, and he set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. And so he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his field to feed pigs. And he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, the father saw him and was filled with compassion for him, and he ran to his son, and he threw his arms around him, and he kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is now found. So they began to celebrate. We call it the prodigal son. It's really the lost son. And I feel particularly anointed to talk about lostness because I spend a good portion of my life lost. I'm wrong way Feldman when it comes to directions. In fact, I'm worse than misdirected. I am right on directions about 63% of the time, which is worse than being wrong all the time, because sometimes I'm right and it fills me with a false sense of confidence. And so I'm inclined to occasionally trust myself. Because I am crippled in this area, the Lord brought to me a woman of God who is the love child of Rand McNally and Daniel Boone. She has natural instincts that tell her where everything is. She is so precise with regard to directions, she routinely challenges GPS. I plug it in. She's like, nope, I don't buy it. I don't think so. And she's almost always right. You know, she grew up in the wild in Minnesota, so she canoed and backpacked and she spelunked and all the things. She literally, it's true. Now, wait a second. You did, though. You told me about carrying a canoe and the water. All right, great. So I'm not sure what the dispute is. We will get our counseling set up later. But all I know is that the first time she rode in my car on a trip, that had GPS, she had a map unfolded on the dash, checking the directions. So when we are lost, this will tell you what the difference. When we are lost somewhere, she will start checking the position of the sun. Right? Where is north? Yeah. Anyway, the thing about being lost is that nobody intends to get there, right? It's always an accident. Nobody ever says, you know what we should do today? Let's just go out and make a series of crazy turns in a neighborhood we don't know. Just see what kind of adventure unfolds. No, it's always you make a turn that you think is right, then you try to correct it with another turn, and you know what I mean? And over time, over a series of decisions, you just get lost. Back in the day, I remember Rocco Wilson will appreciate this especially. I've told this story a couple of times in Rocco's presence. Back in the day, I used to operate a theater, and Rocco designed some of our sets and would help us build them. And I liked to participate in the process, and he would graciously let me, even though I am, how you say, carpentry challenged. I'm not the most manly man in the building arts, but I liked getting in there and getting the sawdust and being a part of the thing, right? And so we were in this one building project, and we build these things when we're making flats. We build these things called scabs, and so it's just a triangle, just a perfect triangle. And he was like, "Okay, I need like 32 of these scabs." And I was like, "You got it." So he's like, "I just need 32 of these." So here's what I did. I took the one he gave me, I traced it, I cut it out. Then I took the one I cut out and I traced it and I cut it out. And by the time I got to number 28, instead of a triangle, I had like a dodecahedron. And it turns out that's not what you're supposed to do. You always work from the original, because here's what happens. When you make a mistake early and you duplicate it over time, you wind up with something you never intended. That's how getting lost works. It's not your intention. The young man in this story never intended to go to the pig pen. It was just a series of decisions that seemed right at the time. They're micro decisions that get you someplace you never intended to be. So how do we get lost? Well, there are a lot of different ways. Probably everyone here has a story, and the ways we get lost are as diverse as people. But I've picked out three specific kind of categories that I think are oftentimes the culprit. The first is that we get deceived by sin. The author of Hebrews in the second chapter said this: "Hey, be careful that your heart is not hardened by the deceitfulness of sin." Sin's tricky because it's deceitful. It poses. It pretends to be one thing when it is in fact something else, right? It presents itself, for instance, as freedom, as an expression of freedom. I remember when I was a young man still living in my mom's home, I had done a show at a high school. Some of you have met my adopted sister and you know her story, but I was working in a high school and I found this. There was a homeless girl who was living in the orchestra pit of the school, and ultimately we wound up adopting her. And she was a great singer, punk rock girl, like purple hair that stood up like really, really high. And when she came into our home, she was just feral. She had lived without rules her whole life and had been homeless for a good chunk of time. And in the early going, my mom was a bit of a disciplinarian. You know, she was like, there were curfews and bedtimes and, you know, chores to do. And she didn't, you know, Charity just didn't like any of that. And after just a few weeks, she was like, "Peace out. I can't take all this. This feels like confinement to me." And she took off, and then just a few weeks later, we found her in the exact same scenario. Because sin will present itself as freedom, And then in the end, you wind up captured in some place you never intended to be. It will present itself as self-expression, an expression of my unique personhood or diversity. It will present itself as something you deserve. Hey, I deserve this. Yeah, it's not, maybe it's not the why, but I'm entitled to this. It's a momentary indulgence. It tells you, you'll just do it once. It's just one time. It's just an indulgence. And then you find yourself in a pig pen and you're like, I never intended to end up here. Addiction is this way. I've told this story before, but some stories are worth repeating. Many years ago, I was in ministry in a church, and one of our leaders had a son who was had a drug problem. And we'd been praying for this young man for some time. And he came back to church, and he came back to the Lord. And it was a great story, and I was discipling the guy, and it was a CBN 700 Club testimony, exactly what you want to hear, right? And then we had a little group of guys that met back in the day. Joe Paul was part of this group. We called ourselves the Flaming Men of Fire. I think it was primarily you, as I recall. I think I wanted the full title, and you kept saying, "Let's call ourselves the Flamers." I think is what you. Anyway, we had this group of people that met. Was Jeff Neely a part of that? Part of that group? I think Jeff was part of that group. Anyway, this guy was coming to that group, and we were all super encouraged at his testimony. And then one day he didn't show up, and that made me nervous. And I called, and he didn't answer. And he didn't show up for band rehearsal. And then he didn't show up on Sunday, and nobody could find him or get in touch with him. And we were just sick. We knew what had happened. And then one Sunday, a couple weeks later, it's the end of service, and he stumbles in the back door, and he looks like a guy that's been on a two-week bender. And he staggered towards me, and I met him on the floor, and I embraced him, and he sobbed. I remember as I was holding him, I was just gagging because he smelled like urine. And I sat down on the steps. We had multiple steps that went up to the platform. It was a large platform. And I sat down, and he sat down next to me, and he laid his head in my lap, and he just sobbed. And then he sat up, and he looked at me. And I'll never forget this moment. It's just emblazoned in my mind. His eyes were bloody. He had ruptured capillaries in his eyes, so it was like blood. And then the iris. And the first words out of his mouth to me, tears streaming down his face, he said, "Pastor Gary, have you ever smoked crack?" And I said, "No." He said, "It's so beautiful." And he just melted into my arms. That is the deceitfulness of sin. It's beautiful while killing you. It promises things it cannot deliver. It abducts you. It numbs you. It kills everything around you. And at some point you look around and you say, "How did I get here? This isn't what I intended." You find out what the prodigal son found out, that as long as you're paying for drinks, there are lots of people to drink with. And then when the party's over, you are left alone with the viper. You know, I think one of the obstacles to people responding to the gospel is this notion, you know, when you talk about sin and sinfulness and that sort of thing, I think people internally say, "But yeah, but that's not me. I'm not evil." And can I say this? In the context in which you mean it, I get it. What you mean is you don't intend evil. Nobody does. It's really very rare that somebody sets out to do bad. I mean, if you will talk to the folks who've done the grossest, most horrible things, what you will find is that they were well-intended. It started off pure enough as a motive. But the problem is none of our motives are pure, including mine. Right? I'm no cleaner. I'm no more pure because I'm the pastor. My human inclination is still towards sin and selfishness. That's what sin is. And it deceives you. It tells you that because your heart doesn't look black to you, that it's not black at all. And that this activity is just a temporary indulgence. And by the time you realize that it's a lie, you're lost. That's one way. Here's another way people get lost. They get damaged by people. Here's the thing. People are generally selfish. They're generally self-centered. They will generally love you as long as your presence in their life moves forward their own agenda. And then if it doesn't, they will dispose of you. They will dispatch you. And when that happens, when you get damaged by people, it is really, really crushing. Here's what I think happens oftentimes with people. I think people get hurt, and to avoid being hurt, they build walls. And those walls, while they do protect you, they also leave you very isolated, cut off from people, and so often cut off from God. At the end of the last service, you know, I taught the same thing in the last service, and we gave an opportunity for folks to respond to the gospel as we will today. And nobody responded that I saw. You don't know what's happening in people's hearts, of course, and so. But I saw a lady standing to the side, and she was just watching. And her eyes looked very glassy, and I walked over. And I said, "Hi, I'm Gary." And she said, "I'm one of those people trapped behind walls." And she just started sobbing. And the people behind those walls, that's not where they want to be. You just do it to protect yourself, and then you find yourself stuck. You find yourself lost. And can I tell you the worst version of this? You come to church because you think it's safe. And then you find out in the worst possible way that the church is filled with people. And the people in church are no different. Listen to me, please get this. You know, I often joke around that 90% of success is lowering expectations. And I would love to lower your expectations here. Because the people in church are just people. Listen, your pastor is just a man. Right? I'm not some higher evolution of created being. I have good days and I have bad days. And there are sometimes I forget to return text. And sometimes I get frustrated and I speak abruptly. And those are just human things. You know what I mean? You never get to a point of spirituality where you don't stop being human. But the thing is, when you're in church, you expect things to be different. And when they're not, man, oh man, is it disappointing. And you get damaged. And for the sake of, and I'm telling you, I've ministered to people in all sorts of situations. I've been to the scenes of accidents. I've sat by the beds of people as they were taking them off life support. I've sat with folks who were going through divorce and cancer. And the worst kind of hurt I've seen is church hurt. It's just something uniquely toxic about it. And even as I share this, there are people who today are cut off from God. And the thing is, when you turn your back and you walk away from church, you cut yourself off from God's best resource for healing you, because God's plan A for propagating the gospel and discipling his people is the church. And plan B doesn't exist because he doesn't need one. There is no plan B. And so you can peace out to the church. But when you do, it's like putting a clamp on your own oxygen tube. And people do that and they just get lost. They get lost. In time, they'll question if their relationship with God was ever real. It's a desperate situation. And here's the third thing. We get disappointed by God. We get deceived by sin, damaged by people. We get disappointed by God. I think one of the more challenging things a believer has to deal with is when the source of your healing is also the source of your pain. Many, many years ago, in my early 20s, I contracted a case of ulcerative colitis. Now, lots of people have ulcerative colitis or different versions of inflammatory bowel disease, and they live with it quite comfortably. It's medically managed 99% of the time. I had a very rare thing that happened. It was sudden onset. I'd never had a problem before. It hit suddenly, and it was uncontrollable. And so over the period of a year, this is a very particular infection that attacks your large bowel. It starts low, and then it works through the entire bowel. When it reaches the end, you get it gets perforated, toxic megacolon, and you die. That's the end of that. And so for a year, doctors did everything that they could. I was in and out of the hospital multiple times. I stayed on constant mega doses of steroids. I ballooned from 185 to 310 in 12 months under steroids. I didn't recognize who I was in the mirror. And in the end, I had one part-time job at a church. It was the only thing that I could maintain. I would dope myself up and get to one choir rehearsal a week. And that part-time thing was my only income. And I lived in the latter stages, I lived in constant, terrific pain and a raging fever that never went away. Nothing would bring it down. So it was like living with the flu constantly. And at the time, I was very young spiritually, and I was not under good pastoral care. I was in a charismatic church whose theology was that sickness is not of the Lord. And so I endured a handful of really terrible prayer meetings where groups would gather around me and try to prophesy over me what were the things that were causing my illness. I was asked to confess every sinful thing I'd ever done, every sinful thought I'd ever had, and I was telling it all. I was doing anything. I would have said anything to stop this plague, and they had convinced me that if I could just find the sin and confess it, I could receive healing, and I confessed and confessed and didn't get better. One day towards the end, we had two or three services on a Sunday morning, and I was leading worship in just tremendous pain. And at the end of the service, a guy approached me. I'd never seen the guy before, and I never saw him again since. He just walked up to me and said, "Hi, my name is whatever his name was. You're the worship leader." And I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Yeah, I'm just visiting here. But today while we were worshiping, the Lord gave me a vision. And I know I'm supposed to share it with you." And I was, I had the worst attitude in the world because I had received so many words on this. You know, I was like, I don't think I can endure another word from the Lord on this issue. But this guy didn't know me or my situation, so I was a little more inclined. And the guy said, "As you were singing this morning, the Lord gave me a vision. And the vision was there was a giant steel hook that was going through the center of your abdomen, and the barb was coming out the back." And there was no way this guy could have known. And so I began to intercede, and I said, "Lord, help this young man. He's in pain." And he said, "I don't know if it's physical pain or emotional pain or spirit, but I saw great pain in your belly, and so I was praying for you." And then it's like the camera pulled out, and on the other end, I saw that the hook was in God's hand. And he wants you to know that what's happening to you is not your fault. This is part of his design. And I know it doesn't make sense, and I know that it's painful, but you don't have to rebuke it, and you don't have to feel condemned. God is at work. And I remember going into my office between service. I was laying on the ground, balled up, sobbing. It didn't make sense. What do you do when the hook is in God's hand? What do you do when you pray for healing and healing doesn't come? When you pray for provision and provision doesn't come? When you've done everything you know to do, and here's what happens, we get disappointed, we get disillusioned. And we do the equivalent of walking out of the movie before the end. Except that I'm here to tell you the end is that God wins and you see his faithfulness. So don't walk out before the end. But some people do. And they find themselves shipwrecked, lost. Because the only source available to them for healing has betrayed them, or at least it feels that way. So how do we find our way back? Well, the boy in the story, the Bible sums it up in one sentence, really. It says he came to his senses. He just woke up one day and said, wait a second. My father's house, however difficult this is going to be, is better than a pig pen. Which is like, you know, that's not genius level thinking, but it's amazing how long it takes us to get there. Hey, this pig pen I'm in is not where I intended to be. This is no way to live. And if you're lost for one of these reasons today, the first thing that has to happen is you have to come to a place where you're honest with yourself, where you say, wait a second, is this where I wanted to be? Did the path I choose take me where I intended to go? And furthermore, if I stay on this path, where does it take me? If you're one of these persons that just doesn't even think about the big picture, the long term, you're just making one decision after next, how's that, as Dr. Phil would say, how's that working for you? You got to be honest with yourself. You have to come to your senses. People rarely lose touch with God as a result of a single decision. It's gradual. And if you're going to come home, it begins with a divine dissatisfaction with where you are. You have to come to a place where you say, well, you know what? I'm not staying here one more minute. I don't know what all the details look like down the line, but I'm not going to stay here. The second thing the son did, he came to his senses and then he went home. So I encourage people to visit the last place they knew God's presence. Where's the last place you remember feeling him and sensing him? This is going to require, though, that you move from where you are right now. You can't just stay still. He came to his senses, he got up, and he moved. Listen to me. If you do what you have always done, then you will get what you've always gotten. If you do nothing different, then nothing will change. You're going to have to relocate. We pray and we seek, and it's as though what we really expect is for God to change everything around us. Lord, come in here to this pig pen and make it not a pig pen anymore. The third thing, and listen, this is the most important single piece of advice that I could give you for your spiritual life. Get ready. This is it. This is the big Megillah. This is the fast pitch across home plate. You can knock it out of the park with this one. The time to respond to the Lord is at the moment he speaks. The time to be obedient is the moment of impulse. The moment he speaks, you get up and you move. You get up and you go. It's the most important advice that I could give you. When we talk about discipleship here at Tapestry, the mission is really, really simple with discipleship. I want to take Vince from wherever he is now to the place where he can hear the voice of the Lord and be obedient to it. Once he can do that, once Bree can do that, you don't need me other than as a cheerleader. Then I become just a friend. So that's what discipleship is. It's getting someone in a position where they can hear from the Lord and be obedient when he speaks. That's what discipleship is all about. But it's one of the features of the voice of the Lord that his word diminishes over time. Listen very carefully to me now. You have, if you've been a part of this church for a while, you've had this experience where you come here and you hear a message that's really high impact. At least I pray that's happened at some point for some of you. You hear a message that's really high impact, right? Wow, hit me right in the chest. 3 days later, you go to describe it to someone and you have trouble remembering. You're like, it was really good. I can't even tell you, like, I know it was about circumcision, but it was really, and they're like, what? Where are you going to church? Yeah, give me the address of Tapestry. But isn't it funny? So high impact on Sunday morning. Like sometimes you're crying and you're taking notes and then you go to talk about it 3 days later and you can't quite remember. And then a week later, you can't remember anything. And a month later, you forgot that it happened at all. It's one of the features of when the Lord speaks. So that makes it doubly important that when he speaks, you are obedient in the moment. And let me tell you something. God is a great steward of his own word. Right? He doesn't throw things away. He wastes nothing. And so over time, if you ignore his word enough, then he'll just stop speaking. He'll just stop. And your relationship with the Lord, the idea of God feeling close and intimate, will be something you remember, but you don't experience. It'll be something in the rearview mirror. And the call to you is to come home. Come home. It's all waiting there for you. What's waiting for you at home? I love this part. First of all, notice that when the son comes home, right? I'm sure what he was expecting is what we would all be expecting from our dad coming home. Where's that nice car you drove off in? Right? But the Bible says he leapt off the porch and came running. He came running for his son. Listen to me, listen to me, listen to me. Your father is running after you today. You're not dealing with a spiritual father who's somehow reluctant, who you have to convince or persuade. Nope. He's coming running after you today. Here's an illustration I like to use. I can't remember if I've used it here or not. Come here, Vince. So, guys, this is Vince. Vince is a big guy and a sharp dresser. He's got a cool girlfriend. All right. So here's how we picture being separated from God. So you're going to turn. I'm going to be God, if that's okay.
That's
okay. All right. All right. Good. And you're going to be a prodigal son. So you're going to turn and face that way, and you're going to walk slowly away. Now he doesn't run away. No one runs away. Right? It's slowly, it's progressive, it's over time. It's one small decision after another. Okay, stop right there. Turn and look. And now you can sense the distance. I'm not out of view. I haven't run away. I'm just not quite in reach. Turn around, walk a little bit more. And he's walking, and he's walking. Just one decision. Not horrible. Stop right there. He's not horrible, gross sins. He's not murdering people. There aren't, you know, dead bodies in the trunk of his car or anything. But just doing his own thing. Just doing his own thing. And he turns and looks. And if he kept going, I would get smaller and smaller and smaller in the horizon. No. All right. Now, come back here. That's the way we envision it, right? And to get close, he's got to take the same journey back. That's the way you picture it, isn't it? Can I show you the way it really works? He walks away, one decision at a time, one dalliance at a time. And then when he turns, I've gone nowhere. You can have a seat. There's no ground to cover. The Lord is there. Why does it seem like he's far away? Because sin is deceitful. It lies to you. So what's waiting at home? Well, the first thing his father gave him, he said, get a robe and put it on his shoulders. Put a robe on his shoulders. See, when the guy had finished in the pig pen, he was naked. Maybe he was just wearing a pair of pants and a torn shirt covered in pig slop. He certainly wasn't dressed like a member of the household. And the father didn't say, take a bath, clean up. He said, get a robe and put it on his shoulders. I don't want him looking like this in front of the other servants and in front of the other kids. In fact, you know, in this version, in Luke's gospel, the father says, get the best robe. Like there were multiple ones. Get the best one and put it on the dirtiest son. And in doing that, restored his dignity. This morning, if you're experiencing shame, it's only shame to you. Words that God has never said. Words that maybe have been spoken over you, but have never come from his mouth, ever. You should be ashamed of yourself. He never says that. When your father encounters your shame, his words are, fetch me the best robe. I want to cover your shame. And he put a ring on his finger. Ring is authority. They didn't have ballpoint pens back in the day. So when they transacted business, a man did it with a signet ring. It was a ring that was his symbol. And so he'd press it in a wax seal. That's how they transferred property. That's how they bought and sold goods. The signet ring was like the credit card of the day. And he says, hey, get one of my rings. Put it on my son's finger. Listen, this isn't even good business. He should have to prove himself. If you were gone 6 months, if you were working for me, you'd have to work for free for 6 months. And then I would make you an apprentice. You give you a chance to prove yourself. God doesn't do that. It's like instant restoration, total access. The restoration of all of your authority the moment you come home. Sandals on his feet. See, bare feet were for slaves. No son of mine is going to be walking around with bare feet. He restored his intimacy. New sandals for these dirty feet caked with pig slop. And then he had a feast. He restored his joy. David said, restore to me the joy of my salvation. And a restoration of joy is one decision away if you're lost. I am a musician by trade. I did my first professional gig at 15 years old at Orion's Roof, the OG Orion's Roof, not this Asian fusion thing they're doing now. This was the real deal. Wendell knows what I'm talking about, the original Orion's Roof. Am I right, brother? Yeah. Cocktail piano, 15 years old on the weekends. That was my first professional thing. And then I got saved. And I don't know where this notion came from, but I just had it in my head that it was wrong to take money for using a gift that God gave me. I felt like money was for people who worked, and playing the piano was a blessing. It wasn't work. And so I was in my early 20s, I was working three jobs. I worked at Kenny's Shoes. I was an assistant manager during the days at Lynn Haven Mall. Then I delivered Pizza Hut pizza during the lunch rush and the dinner rush. And then I would nap in my car, and I was the night auditor at the Dunes Motor Inn. So that was my schedule all the time. And I was constantly turning down opportunities to play piano because I didn't want to get paid for something God had given me. That was just where I was, really dumb and young. When I went through this medical crisis, I was in the hospital for a couple of months. The hospital bill alone approached $1 million, no insurance. And then I came home. Oh, by the way, while I was in, so when I was taken to the ER, I'm just going to finish this story and we'll be done. When I went to the ER, I was critical. So they had to put me on intravenous steroids for 3 or 4 days to get me strong enough to withstand a surgery. I was unconscious for all of this. While I was unconscious, the senior pastor from the church called to tell me I was fired because they weren't sure if I was going to live or not, and they needed a worship leader. So when I recovered, you want to talk about church hurt? When I can laugh about it now. I'm cool, everyone. But the first message I got, like 2 weeks after, you know, surgery, I picked it up, and it was, "Hey, this is Pastor so-and-so. We're praying for you. Listen, we're just going to go ahead and terminate you. We've got a good candidate here, and we're not sure what the future is going to be. But listen, if there's anything we can do for you, you let us know. We're going to be lifting you up." That was like, so then I came home, and I was 4 or 5 months before I could drive or anything. It was a very, very tenuous situation. And we were dying financially. Like, I just wasn't sure what was going to happen. And there was this guy who owned a recording studio here locally who kept calling. And I had turned him down 1 million times because I didn't take money for playing. And he called and he said, "Listen, I know you've been sick. I don't know what you're able to do, but I've got this project. And I really need a pro-level piano track. I can pay you $1,000 if you can get yourself to your keyboard and computer and turn this around for me." And to me, $1,000, that sounded like $1 million to me. $1,000, like. So I just said, "Lord, I'm so sorry. I have to do this, but I have to do this." And so I did that track for $1,000. And then he came back 2 days later with another track, and he started sending me all this work that I could do while I had this giant zipper that I was healing from. And then after a while, I started doing all these tracks, and then I got a call from the Barksdale Dinner Theater in Richmond saying, "Hey, could you come?" And the point is, it opened up this whole avenue of music that I'm walking in today I never would have walked in. I never would have. I was just determined. I was just going to keep working three jobs, and I didn't know what God had for me. And you don't know what God's doing in your life. You don't know what all he's accomplishing. And you won't know unless you come home. So stand with me. I'm going to ask the worship team to come forward. And I want to pray for you all. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pray, and then we're going to sing. And if you are here this morning, and I've been talking to you in any regard, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to the voice of the Lord. And I want you to remember, the best time to respond to his voice is at the moment of impulse, the moment he speaks. And if you are willing to move, and remember, you got to move. If you do what you've always done, you'll get what you've always got. But if you're willing to make a move, take a step out, the Lord will come running and meet you. He's got a robe that's ready for you. He's got a ring. He's got sandals. And this morning, we have the unique opportunity to tell you, not only will we pray for you, we could baptize you right now. We have extra shirts and shorts and everything right back here. We could just do it right now. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pray. And then the worship team is going to sing. And if you're here and this applies to you, then I want you to come forward. Or maybe you're here and you've been walking with the Lord, but you've never followed him in obedience in baptism. Well, then come on forward. Let's do that. We'll take care of that this morning. And you don't have to be a member of this church. You're not joining this church by doing it. This isn't about church or religion. This is about your relationship with the Lord. So I'm not a guy to try to pull on heartstrings or anything. So I'm going to pray. As soon as they sing, we're going to have a chorus or two. You come down, shake my hand, tell me what you want to do, and then we'll move on to these baptisms. Father, in Jesus' name, I pray for everyone in the sound of my voice in this room or listening by recording or whatever it might be. God, I pray just as Chris said, Lord, that they would recognize the voice of the Lord speaking to them. It's not an audible voice. It's a racing heart. It's this something in the pit of their stomach that says, come home. Something that's being drawn towards you. God, I pray that anyone in that position will respond in obedience in this moment. And I pray that in Jesus' name.